Hello and welcome to another podcast of U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Gene. This is Jimmy LaSalle. Today's podcast covers the war in Europe, the Allies' strategy, the goings-on here in the U.S., and then the end of the war on the European front. There's a lot to cover in this one, so let's get going with resident history expert Gene Anzanakis. Jeannie, take it away.
We left off talking about the D-Day invasion, and we're going to go back a little bit. We're going to talk about Normandy very, very briefly, and we're going to talk about World War II in Europe and even the home front in the United States all the way up until the end of fighting in Europe. So quite a bit to discuss today. I want to start off talking about our alliances. So you often hear the saying, the big three, the United States, Great Britain, the Soviet Union, but we weren't always allies with the Soviet Union during World War II. They switched sides after Germany attacks the Soviet Union. We were allies with Stalin, but ideologically, we could not have been more different. World War II makes both the United States and the Soviet Union world powers. The alliance would be short-lived. When Germany was defeated and the Soviet Union looked to expand territory, it was obvious that their goal was to spread communism beyond their current borders. But we're going to get more into this in our series of episodes on the Cold War. The United States and the Soviet alliance from 1941 to 45 was a strained one. Nothing like a common enemy to bring two countries together. The history between the two countries was not one that screamed potential ally either. The United States did not have diplomatic relations with Russia since 1917. The United States did not recognize the Soviet Union. During his first year in office, FDR changes this. After months of negotiations, the United States formally recognized the Soviet Union in November of 1933. He hoped that in doing so, it would help to limit Japanese expansion in Asia. In exchange, the Soviet Union agreed to hold talks to discuss the debt that the former regime had with the United States. And in addition, the Soviet Union agreed not to aid in any way the United States Communist Party. When World War II began in Europe, FDR condemned the Soviet Union for its non-aggression pact with Germany and its involvement in the war with Poland and Finland, its seizure of various territories, Stalin's violence against political opposition and citizens alike strained this newly budding relationship. It became diplomatically necessary for the United States to begin talks with the Soviets in the hopes of improving relations after the fall of France to the Nazis. When Hitler ordered the invasion of Russia in June of 1941, the United States extended the Lend-Lease Act to include the Soviet Union. The countries worked together to defeat Germany. Stalin requested help along the Eastern Front in order to help fight off the Germans. This help was delayed. While FDR, Churchill, and Stalin were allies, there was a sense of distrust, and rightfully so. FDR, Churchill, and Stalin, as I mentioned, were known as the Big Three. And FDR did quite a bit to kind of secure this relationship with Stalin in the hopes that when war was over, they could kind of maintain ties, that the countries could work together. But if you're a student of history, you know that that wasn't possible. I want to talk about the home front a bit. So World War II in the United States. Unlike our allies, aside from Pearl Harbor, fighting is not happening on our shores. So what is it like here? In the United States, we are rationing. You have the start of what become known as Victory Gardens. There are 20 million Victory Gardens planted during the war, and this program reduced the demand for commercially grown vegetables, things like packaging materials and different transportation needs. Americans were encouraged to grow their own food, to preserve it, to can their surplus harvests. And by 1944, 40% of the nation's produce came from victory gardens. By the spring of 1942, we have rationing programs that are established in order to set the limits on the amount of gas, food items, clothing even, that consumers were able to purchase. Families were issued ration stamps that were used to buy their allotment from things like meat, sugar, fat, butter, different vegetables and fruits, to things like gas, tires, and clothing. Local rationing boards were set up, and they were manned by volunteers who were tasked with handing out the booklets, but they also had to explain this process to the American people. Items that were made with restricted items not only cost money, but a certain number of ration stamps. And once you used them, you couldn't get any more. The government issued a certain number of points to each person in the household. And just because you had the right coupon didn't mean you were going to leave the store with that item. You know, for those of us old enough and brave enough at the start of COVID, you know what it was like to go into supermarkets and to see bare shelves, or to not be able to get certain essential items. You know, one of my favorite stories, when I couldn't find toilet paper, is I finally tracked down toilet paper and it was made from recycled paper. And my husband goes to me, "Well, what is it? What does it look like?" I was like, "Well, it's not quite white toilet paper, but it worked." You have to get creative. You had to search for substitutes. Same thing during World War II. There were different color stamps for different items. You have red stamps, for example. They allowed you to buy things like meat, oils, and butter. You have blue stamps, which were for frozen and canned fruits and vegetables, different juices, beans, and other processed foods. And if you wanted items that were harder to find due to rationing, like coffee, sugar, rubber, clothing, shoes, those had their own stamps. Meanwhile, you have individuals and communities that are conducting drives for the collection of things like scrap metal, aluminum cans, rubber. All of these things are recycled and are used to produce armaments. People became resourceful. As gasoline was rationed and new tires were not easy to find, people purchased bicycles to help them get around. Certain foods became popular during the war because they were inexpensive and easy to make. Kraft macaroni and cheese, for example, became popular. In the quest to make food last longer, especially on the battlefield, dehydrated potatoes were invented, and they allowed for the creation eventually of things like Pringles. When women couldn't find pantyhose or stockings in the stores, many would draw as straight as they could lines down the backs of their legs with marker to mimic the seam of the pantyhose of the stockings, so that from far away it would look as though they were wearing stockings. People did without so that those needed supplies could go to the war effort, or they could go to feed our soldiers fighting overseas. War bonds. Individuals purchased U.S. war bonds to help pay for the high cost of armed conflict. War bonds allowed the government to raise money for the military without having to raise taxes significantly. But make no mistake about it, the federal government did raise taxes to pay for the war. About 40% of the war was funded through direct taxes on the American people. But those war bonds are marketed as being, you know, every time you purchase a war bond, you're supporting the government. You're making a commitment to the nation's cause. Maybe you're not young enough to fight. You can buy a war bond, right? The campaigns to promote these bonds were multifaceted. You have propaganda posters that would be on the walls of public places. You have radio broadcasts that would go into the living rooms of families. Celebrities of the day and Hollywood icons would use their star power to promote the cause. The message was clear. Purchasing a war bond was a direct contribution to the nation's victory. These bonds not only helped to fund the war, but also helped to prevent inflation. Americans were more than willing to curtail their own personal spending and to make what seemed like a very simple sacrifice compared to the sacrifices that soldiers were making by giving their lives. And according to the U.S. Treasury Department, more than 85 million Americans, which was about half of the U.S. population at the time, purchased war bonds, and they had helped to raise $185 billion. Now, the average American worker, probably one of the most recognizable symbols is probably that of Rosie the Riveter, that famous World War II propaganda image of a strong woman wearing, you know, a red bandana and blue coveralls. There's a song that came out in 1942 called Rosie the Riveter by Kay Kaiser, and it's a great way to introduce this topic to your class. It's real catchy, and it always spurs a great discussion. American women, yes, they held war-related jobs, but they also were working in industries that they had not been working in before. They're working in business offices, they're working in factories, farms, various other enterprises. By the mid-1940s, the percentage of women in the American workforce had expanded from 25% to 36%. There were more than 500,000 Black Rosies who worked alongside their white counterparts in the war effort. At the peak of wartime industrial production, some 2 million women worked in war-related industries. For women of color, these new opportunities were especially important because it allowed for them to work in jobs beyond that of domestic servant or sharecropper. These jobs did not come easily, and many white male business owners held out to only hire white women who they would not have hired either had all the men not been at war. Executive Order 8802 was signed by FDR to limit and hopefully put an end to widespread hiring discrimination. Regulations to prevent wage discrimination didn't prevent Black and white women from being paid less than men, or from Black women being paid less than white women. The struggles became part of a much larger campaign for equality in the post-World War II years, known as the Double V campaign, which I'll talk a bit more about in a bit. The United States Office of War Information was a government agency that operated from 1942 until 1945. Most Americans didn't understand why the world was at war, and the information that was coming out seemed confusing to some. The agency helped to provide Americans with information through posters, newspapers, movie reels, radio broadcasts. The agency had overseas branches which worked to spread propaganda, and even went as far as revising film scripts which could portray the United States in a negative light. You have to understand that the creation of this agency did raise some eyebrows, especially with the press. Can we trust having just one provider of information? Can we trust the government to give accurate information? That same question rings true today. Can we trust that? Women in World War II. 350,000 women served the country during World War II. Today, over 3 million women have served in or with the United States military since the American Revolution. A 2021 Defense Department study showed that 17% of the active duty force of the military is made up of women. From the outset of our direct involvement in World War II, the country faced a two-front war. American women were tapped to fulfill the needed military and workforce labor shortages. Public Law 554 created the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. This law was introduced by Congresswoman Edith Norse Rogers from Massachusetts. The hope that was by allowing women to serve, it would free men for combat. Originally, the bill outlined that women would have the same military status and benefits as men. the law was not popular until after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and it was only passed once the provision was made that women would not be given active military status. 350,000 women served in the armed forces during World War II. They were not permitted to serve in combat positions. Over the course of the war, 432 women were killed and 88 had been taken prisoner. Women served as nurses during the American Revolution. Since 1901, branches like the Army Nurse Corps and the Navy Nurse Corps were established. Women who served in this capacity paved the way for women to have the opportunity to serve in other branches and in other capacities in the U.S. military. At its outset, the Women's Army Corps didn't receive equal pay or benefits to men. In 1943, it became an official part of the U.S. Army, and it allowed its members to serve overseas to receive benefits if they were killed or injured. For women who served in the military, they had a number of obstacles. A number of obstacles still exist for women in the military today. In order to recruit women for these positions, the public had to be persuaded that, and this is a quote, a woman could join the army but still be a lady. The National Archives have incredible War Department propaganda videos urging women to join. You hear terms like petticoat soldiers. Women were shown as X-ray techs, meat inspectors, teachers, mechanics repairing vehicles, or even repairing planes. They took an oath to live up to the legends of their fighting men. The housewife and the girl next door were all encouraged to enlist. Black women served in separate units. The military is still segregated at this time in history. The U.S. Navy established what became known as WAVES. That stands for, women accepted for volunteer emergency services. WAVES were classified as reservists. They were not permitted to serve overseas until 1945, which even then were limited to Hawaii and Alaska, which are not yet states. That's why it's considered overseas. Women were also not permitted to serve on Navy vessels. Black women were not permitted to join until 1944. Women were expected to serve temporarily or on an emergency basis, and they did not have a full sense of belonging within the military despite answering the call of duty to their country. The Marines, a branch of the U.S. Marines, were created for women. There was a call to create a feminine nickname for those enlisted in the Marines. One example was Glamarines. I hope you are all doing the same eye roll that I am doing with that one. Thankfully, the commander in charge declined and said if they join the Marines, they are a Marine. Like the Waves, women who joined the Marines were classified as reservists and were often referred to as WRs. Black women were not allowed to enlist. The first woman of color was able to enlist in 1949. Now, Black Americans and World War II. Over 1 million Black Americans served in World War II. Civil rights leaders pressured the U.S. government to allow Black Americans to serve in integrated units, but the military remained segregated. Black soldiers were fighting a two-front war. They were fighting for democracy abroad, but they were fighting to be treated as first-class citizens at home. I mentioned earlier the Double V campaign, victory at home and victory abroad. This was a campaign started by an African-American publication called the Pittsburgh Courier. The movement caught national attention. It highlighted the irony of Black soldiers going to war to fight for democracy and against tyranny abroad, and yet at home in the United States, they were segregated from white Americans. They faced harsh forms of discrimination. They were prevented from voting or even registering to vote. Many are being lynched. So the prevailing prejudice of the era dictated that many Black servicemen were assigned to support roles, limiting their opportunities to engage directly in combat operations. This segregation was not confined to the battlefield. It extended into every facet of military life, including training camps and even prisoner of war circumstances. Reflecting the deeply entrenched racial divisions within American society at the time, many military bases located in southern states that had strict Jim Crow laws required there to be separate blood banks, separate hospitals, separate barracks, separate recreational facilities. Many Black troops were not allowed to serve in combat units, and they were appointed to serve as cooks, mechanics, or they served in units that were assigned labor jobs like digging ditches, building roads, loading and unloading military vehicles. The 761st Tank Battalion was the first Black division to see ground combat in World War II when they joined Patton's Third Army in France in 1944. They were known as the Black Panthers, a famous name most will recognize from the 761st Battalion is Jackie Robinson, the famous baseball player who helped to desegregate baseball. Robinson was actually moved to another battalion after refusing to move to the back of a bus. He was court-martialed for his actions, but he was later cleared of the charges against him. The 761st were trained to handle equipment for 2 years, a much longer time than white soldiers were trained. The Black Panthers, as they were known, fought in northern France in the Battle of the Bulge. They served under Patton. Patton himself was quoted as saying that he didn't feel Black soldiers were as capable as white soldiers, a belief he continued on with after the war. During the war, that unit received a presidential unit citation, and a large number of individual members of the 761st received medals like the Medal of Honor. There are 11 Silver Star recipients and 300 recipients of the Purple Heart. Another group that I want to discuss are the Tuskegee Airmen. The Tuskegee Airmen were the first African-American U.S. military pilots. Black Americans tried to serve as military pilots before, but they were turned away. It wasn't until 1939, after considerable amounts of pressure and advocacy by groups like the NAACP, that the U.S. government set aside funds to train Black Americans as pilots. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, in 1940, there were only 124 African American pilots in the United States. The men were trained at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. The men were required to all have college degrees, and they are held to the same physical fitness standards as other members of the Army. Over 16,000 Black Americans trained at Tuskegee. Of that number, 350 were deployed and saw combat. Within that number of 16,000, you also have Black women who are being trained and working as mechanics, as test pilots, as parachute technicians. Many of the Tuskegee Airmen had double the amount of combat missions than their white counterparts. Many of the men were awarded medals for their bravery, and the Tuskegee Airmen were collectively awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in 2007. Black men and women fought to be able to have the same opportunity in the military, to fight in combat, and they did so for a government whose laws held them as second-class citizens. They couldn't order a meal at a lunch counter. They had to sit at the back of the bus or on a different train car. They had to attend different schools. Many soldiers on leave were denied service at hotels that were for whites only. Some men were even lynched while wearing their military uniforms. When we talk about the concept of the Double V campaign, Black soldiers are fighting for democracy abroad, but they're also fighting for it at home in the United States. Okay, World War II weaponry. There's a lot to talk about. I'm only going to mention a handful of things. technology had improved since the end of World War I. We have fighter jets, we have sonar technology to combat U-boats, we have cavity magnetrons, which is considered one of the most important advancements made during World War II. It helped to improve radar capabilities. And this technology, which allowed for microwaves, became increasingly popular and is still used today. As the adage goes, necessity is the mother of invention. The war years saw technological advancements on a scale never before witnessed. It propels the world into a new age, the nuclear age. And I'm going to have a whole separate episode on the atomic bomb, but yes, one of the major advancements during World War II. The field of aviation saw a number of advancements. This era gives birth to breakthroughs such as jet propulsion, radar systems, long-range bombing, and the naval integration of aircraft carriers. The B-29 Superfortress, with its pressurized cabin, remote-controlled gun turrets, these all represented, cutting-edge technologies. Tanks, they were an integral part of the war effort. They underwent massive redesigns. They could go faster. They were more heavily armored. They had better firepower. And it's not just the United States that are making these technological advances. The Germans have made great advancements in their weaponry, the Soviets. So you have all of these new, unique designs that have all of these incredible capabilities, and the death toll on both sides is going to be massive. You have submarine technology that's being enhanced, and they can perform much better underwater. A significant aspect of these improvements was the focus on increasing the submarine's ability to stay underwater for longer periods of time. Prior to World War II, submarines are primarily surface vessels that could submerge for short periods. However, the advent of more efficient battery systems and air purification technology during the war, it allows submarines to remain underwater for extended periods, making them even more elusive to enemy forces. The tools used to detect and track them also evolved significantly. Sonar technology, a relatively new invention during World War II, was quickly adopted and improved upon. This technology was critical in locating enemy submarines underwater. The torpedoes carried by these submarines were also refined. Improvements in guidance systems, in propulsion, the explosive power resulted in more effective and lethal weapons, making, submarines a formidable threat to surface vessels. You have code breaking. Code breaking stands as a shining example of the pivotal role that intelligence played during the war. The relentless efforts of code breakers, most notably those stationed at, Bletchley Park in the United Kingdom, they were instrumental in deciphering the complex Enigma codes used by Germany. Through the application of intricate algorithms and the creation of early computers, the team at Bletchley Park managed to crack those codes, and it provided the Allies with insight into German strategies, into their plans. In the United States, 10,000 American women worked as code breakers. The women took a vow of secrecy, the old saying, loose lips sink ships. That's where it comes from. These women told their families that they were going to be doing secretarial work. The intelligence field was just in its early stages. Agencies like the CIA have yet to be created. These women somehow made sense of what at first glance would appear to be a sequence of nonsensical letters. This was a very high-stress job. You make a mistake and people die. I would be remiss if I also didn't discuss the Navajo code talkers. During World War II, the complexities of the Navajo language made it an ideal choice. It's not a written language, and very few people that are not Navajo Indian are able to speak it. In 1942, 29 Navajos were enlisted to create a Navajo code. Over 400 would eventually take part in the program. Every major Pacific theater operation the Marines were involved in utilized Navajo code. The operation wasn't declassified until 1968. The original 29 code talkers were awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2000 by President Bill Clinton. The introduction of advanced reconnaissance techniques provided critical visual data for the battlefield. The advent of aerial photography via specialized reconnaissance aircraft offered military strategists a bird's eye view of enemy positions, fortifications, and even movements. One of the major things that the US government focused on this time around were veterans, the GI Bill. What is going to happen with soldiers when they return from war? FDR planned for the return of soldiers, and he wanted to ensure better conditions and opportunities for our servicemen than had been done for them after World War I and earlier wars. If you remember, we discussed things like the bonus army and how World War I, you know, vets had to march on Washington in order to demand better help after the First World War. Much of their demands were not met. This time around, there were bipartisan support for the bill that had been promoted by the American Legion. The American Legion has consistently lobbied Congress for better benefits for veterans. The bill provided a number of financial rewards, things like low-cost mortgages, low-interest loans, 1 year of unemployment compensation, along with money for tuition for higher education. So this GI Bill of 1944, it was for any World War II vet who served at least 90 days, who hadn't been dishonorably discharged. Many Black veterans found it difficult to obtain those low-cost mortgages, loans, or money for higher education. The GI Bill allowed for returning vets to purchase homes, to start a business, to attend college, or to attend vocational schools. For many throughout the United States, college was not a realistic option. Many had a high school education, or they quit high school in order to get a job and to help with paying the bills. You know, my grandfather, also Jim's grandfather, fought in World War II. Our paternal grandfather, he quit high school during his third year. He said he was tired of not having any money in his pocket. And he was older when he enlisted to fight in World War II. He was born in 1909. And when the war was over, he married my grandmother and they started a family. Now that you have a glimpse of what life was like in the United States during the war years, let's get back to the battlefront. When the war was coming to an end, it was FDR's hope that if they could satisfy the basic concerns of the Soviets, have them involved in the newly created United Nations, that the Soviets could be an international team player. Now, this did not happen for a variety of reasons. The Allies had to decide how they were going to defeat Hitler and chip away at Germany's empire that it had built. A glance at a world map underscores the stark geographic contrast between the European and the Pacific theaters of World War II. Europe's theater was largely a land-centric conflict. It sprawled over very diverse terrains and landscapes, for sure, but transportation and logistics were comparatively easier to manage given the shorter distances between the nations and the battlefronts. It was a war fought in the backyard of many European nations, where every inch of the land bore witness to the fierce face-off between the Allies and the Axis powers. The European theater was massive. It's divided into key territories. You have the Western Front, which consisted of Denmark, Norway, Luxembourg, Belgium, the Netherlands, the UK, France, and Germany. And then you have the Mediterranean theater and Northern Africa. And this included French Africa, still the age of imperialism, Spain, Portugal, and Italy. In June of 1942, Major General Dwight D. Eisenhower was selected to lead U.S. forces in Europe. Eisenhower, while he had no combat experience, his knowledge of military strategy and his organizational skills made him a natural fit for the task. Eisenhower, along with others, helped to plan the European war strategy, and he convinced the Army Chief of Staff to create a position that would oversee all operations in Europe. Eisenhower was surprised when he was the one selected for that very position. That position was known as the Supreme Commander of Allied Expeditionary Forces. Other well-known generals in the European theater included people like George Marshall, Omar Bradley, and George Patton. A series of planning conferences took place in 1943 among Allied leaders. In May of 1943, FDR and Churchill agreed to hold off the Normandy landings until the spring of 1944 so that they could build up supplies and troops for what they knew was going to be an expansive invasion. The next important meeting was in Cairo, Egypt, in November of 1943. The meeting was codenamed Sextant, and it set the stage for a post-war Asia after the defeat of Japan. Japan would lose all islands in the Pacific they occupied since World War I. Chinese territories would be given back to China, and Korea would gain its independence. The second major conference was in Tehran, and it was the first time that FDR, Churchill, and Stalin all met together. The three powers decided on a Germany-first policy. In December of 1943, Churchill and FDR met in Cairo again, this time discussing the possibility of Turkey joining the war. Turkey's neutrality meant that Hitler was stopped from accessing Middle Eastern oil supplies. Turkey didn't join World War II until February of 1945. They did so in order to meet the deadline for countries to join the United Nations by declaring war on Germany by March 1st, 1945. On the European front, some major battles were the Battle of Britain. This proved to be a significant aerial battle that altered the course of the war. The Royal Air Force defied all the odds to successfully ward off the Luftwaffe's relentless air raids. The Luftwaffe is the name of the German Air Force. They had a heroic victory that really allowed for some hope in the midst of just widespread gloom of war, years worth of war. Equally consequential was the brutal Battle of Stalingrad, regarded as one of the deadliest battles in history. It signaled a significant shift in war dynamics, placing the Axis powers on the back foot. Stalingrad's shattered ruins bore witness to the collapse of the German war machine. It marked the beginning of the end for the Axis powers in Eastern Europe. The D-Day invasion remains etched in global memory as a monumental milestone in the European theater, and we had a whole episode on D-Day. I hope you listened to it. In February of 1945, the Big Three, FDR, Churchill, and Stalin, met again at Yalta, which was a resort city on the coast of the Black Sea. Stalin agreed to join the fight in the Pacific after the defeat of Hitler. The fate of post-war Germany was also decided at Yalta. After the defeat of Hitler and the Nazis, Germany would be divided into four zones. The zones would be controlled by the United States, by the British, the French, and Soviets. The city of Berlin was also going to be divided. Germany was to be demilitarized. They had to assume some responsibility for the war, and they had to pay reparations. Stalin took a hard line when it came to Eastern European territories like Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Bulgaria. While Stalin promised political freedom and elections in these territories, he had no intention of keeping those promises. Stalin agreed to join the United Nations only after it was agreed that the five founding members would hold a veto power. The Big Three agreed to meet again after the defeat of Germany. Now, we've spent a lot of time talking about Germany, but Italy is also one of the Axis powers. The Italian campaign began in 1943. Allied forces invaded Sicily and looked to work their way up the Italian peninsula. The goal was to remove Italy from the war and to secure dominance of the Mediterranean. The Italian army's invasion of northern Africa and the heavy losses the Italian army faced there and in Stalingrad made both the war and Mussolini unpopular. On July 24th, 1943, Mussolini was voted out of power and was arrested and sent to an island. German forces rescued Mussolini, brought him to northern Italy, which was under German control, and essentially installed him as a puppet leader there. On April 25th, 1945, Mussolini fled Milan in the hopes of reaching the Swiss border. He was captured 2 days later. It is believed that Mussolini was killed by a firing squad. His body was taken back to Milan, where angry crowds pelted, spat, and beat his corpse. His body was hanged upside down in the square, along with the bodies of other fascists and his mistress. With Mussolini defeated, let's go and talk about the defeat of Germany. In March of 1945, the Allied forces crossed the Rhine River and they began their march towards the heart of the Third Reich. An American soldier was quoted as saying, "When they marched through France, they were liberators. But when they marched through Germany, they were conquerors." As city after city was liberated, U.S. troops found that high-ranking Nazi officials, SS officers, and their families had all committed suicide instead of surrendering or being captured by Allied forces. As the United States, Great Britain, and France attacked Germany from the west, Stalin and the Soviet Union closed in on the east, each quickly closing in on the city of Berlin. For the majority of the war, capturing Berlin was the prize. By the early months of 1945, the Soviet army was only 40 miles out of Berlin. The United States and British forces had been stalled by the Battle of the Bulge. General Eisenhower made the decision not to push his advance into Berlin and to allow Stalin's army to take the city. This was not a decision that the British were happy about. Eisenhower argued that the potential loss of 100,000 American soldiers for territory that under the agreement drawn up at Yalta would go to the Soviet Union anyway. So let them take it, let their soldiers die. Eisenhower had no way of knowing that Stalin wouldn't exit these territories and that the Cold War would emerge and last for decades. Soviet forces didn't just capture Berlin, but they were able to get their hands on all of the scientific advances that the Germans had made in their quest to build an atomic bomb of their own. Germany had stockpiled uranium and other nuclear raw materials in the hopes of being successful in that quest. After the war ended, both the United States and the Soviet Union recruited German scientists and engineers, and they resettled them in their respective territories. The advance into Berlin was not an easy one. It took 9 days for the Soviets to get into the city of Berlin because of the heavy German defenses around the city. The Soviet army attacked the city from the north, the south, and the east. In Germany, the defeat of Nazi forces in Hungary to the Soviet army led Hitler to make a decree to have all of Germany's infrastructure destroyed, so that the conquering armies would not be able to use any of it. A high-ranking Nazi official intervened and he stopped this from happening. As the situation worsened, Hitler entered his bunker, on January 16, 1945, where he remained for 105 days until his suicide on April 30, 1945. The bunker was located 55 feet beneath the chancellery. The news of the death of Mussolini and how his body was mutilated by the public spurred Hitler to commit suicide and to have his body burned. On April 30th, Hitler shot himself and his wife, who he had only married the day before, Eva Braun, took a cyanide tablet to kill herself, and they died together. Hitler didn't want to take cyanide because he feared that the pill wouldn't work. He gave it to his dog, who he actually loved, and it did in fact work, and it killed his dog. Later, dental records were used to positively identify his remains. The German state announced his death in a radio broadcast the next day. There were somber drum rolls as it was announced over the radio. And this is a direct quote. It is reported from the Führer's headquarters that Adolf Hitler, fighting to the last breath against Bolshevism, fell for Germany this afternoon at his operational headquarters in the Reich Chancellery. It was announced by his hand-picked successor, someone by the name of Grand Admiral Dönitz. Hitler had it written in his will when the war ended, that hand-picked successor. He was tried for war crimes at Nuremberg, and he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. Hitler's death announcement was, of course, a lie. He hadn't died in battle. He committed suicide. The truth would come out only after Germany's surrender. As news of Hitler's death was announced throughout the world, people cheered. Global headlines read, "Hitler dead," in bold print. At a press conference, President Harry Truman declared that Hitler was in fact dead, but that he didn't have the details of how he died. On May 5th, 1945, the Soviets found two charred remains near the bunker. Reports indicate that what was left of the bodies were thrown into the river to prevent Hitler's burial site from becoming a shrine. The Soviets kept a portion of his skull, which showed a bullet hole, and a fragment of his jaw, which dental records were able to link those remains to that of Hitler. It wouldn't be until the year 2000 when Hitler's jaw and skull fragment were put on display in Moscow. On May 7th, 1945, General Alfred Jodl of the Wehrmacht signed the terms of unconditional surrender. Jodl would be charged with a variety of war crimes at Nuremberg and was executed. The document was signed in Reims, France, and went into effect the next day. May 8th, 1945 is celebrated as VE Day. This stands for Victory in Europe. VE Day is still commemorated today. The celebrations that day in 1945 were joyous. Years and years of war were now over. In London, crowds celebrated in Trafalgar Square, and King George VI and Queen Elizabeth went out onto the balcony of Buckingham Palace with Winston Churchill, along with their two daughters, the future Queen Elizabeth II and Princess Margaret, in order to wave to the more than a million people celebrating in front of the palace. In Paris, people gathered along the Champs-Élysées and at the Arc de Triomphe. Celebrations continued in Paris for 2 days. In the United States, flags were still at half-mast to mourn FDR. The man who led the country almost through its entirety didn't live to see its end. President Truman dedicated the victory over Germany to FDR's memory. Celebrations in New York's Times Square went into the wee hours of the morning. People waved newspapers, danced in the streets, climbed on top of cars, and even to the top of lampposts. War in Europe was over, but the war in the Pacific raged on.
And I think that's probably where we're going to go with our next podcast, isn't it, Jeannie?
We are actually going to be discussing America and the Holocaust, what we knew, what we didn't know. That will be our next episode, and that's going to be a two-part episode. Who knew what and when? And I think it's episodes that everybody should take a time to listen to.
Yeah, no, and I'm sure you're going to share some of your own experiences that you had in visiting Auschwitz. No.
Yes, I went and saw Auschwitz, and it was really
let's not give people okay. too much information. Right, we want them to tune into the next podcast.
Well, I'll be sure to talk about it in the next episode.
All right. Well, Thank you for listening to U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Gene. Tell your friends about our podcast and where you learn all this great stuff about U.S. history. Follow us on social media and get onto our email list to learn about special events. They're coming up again. There's always more to learn. Talk to you soon.